Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
We're back for the secret podcast, the subscriber podcast. Don't tell anybody. It's, you know, no, you should tell people. Tell people that it's great and that they should subscribe to get it.
It is a huge, huge bonus. And let me tell you, there's stuff in here you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, you can't get the sound. Unless you come to my street on a Friday morning, you can't get the sound of the recycling truck.
Whew,
but it's out
that
there.
That is good podcasting.
People don't know, well, actually, if they listen carefully, they do know that on Clockwise, Clockwise is recorded at noon Eastern on Wednesdays, and that is exactly when the recycling truck is coming down your street.
Yeah, yeah, often right at the end of the show, like close to 12:30, and they are...
It's the bonus topic.
Like clockwork, some might say.
Well, so I got you back here.
Thank you. Well, it's good that our listeners are able to hear all ends of the garbage truck spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah, from East Coast to West Coast, garbage trucks unite us.
Indeed, they bring us together.
And take away our garbage.
We all have garbage, Jason. We all have garbage.
Our garbage will be together in the dump.
This is not this podcast, hopefully.
No. So working on the Six Colors magazine, which should be out in the next couple of days. And you wrote a piece in there about personal technology.
I did.
And I wrote a thing about complexity in systems and how that relates to Apple. I got one piece left to write, but the one that really amused me was we got a request from listener and subscriber Diane about tea, because we both said that we drink tea, and so our What I Use segment in the magazine is about tea this time.
Yeah, well, tea, like garbage trucks, bring us together as well. I love tea, and I wrote, you know, for the now defunct The Magazine, run by our former comrades, Glenn Fleischman and before him Marco Arment. I wrote a thing about tea several years ago at this point. And I read a book about tea, which was very interesting. And so I think that I wouldn't say that has necessarily informed or changed my tea drinking behavior. But yeah, I don't know. So the challenging thing, as always, I think, about being a tea drinker is this U.S. specifically seems very geared towards coffee drinkers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned that in my part of that piece that this is a coffee country, and, you're being a tea drinker in most places. I mean, I'm not complaining. It's just, that's the facts that there are coffee shops everywhere. And it's very rare. Jackie Ching, who's now the editor in chief of the Wirecutter, She took me to a tea shop in Chicago once, Argo Tea, and I was really excited about that because I thought it quite novel that there was something that was kind of like a Pete's or a Starbucks, but it was for tea.
Yeah.
Because that's so rare. And usually, you know, the coffee places will have tea. Sometimes they have, you know, a tea bag, or they've got a few. If you're at a hotel and you ask for tea, they'll bring you like some of them. There's that question, right? Do they bring you the box with the selection, or do they bring you the Lipton?
Yeah, well, so that's
I don't want the Lipton.
The sliding scale, right? Like you start the Lipton, which is uniformly terrible, and then you work your way up to maybe a selection of some bags. And if you're at a really good restaurant, sometimes they even have loose leaf tea, and they might bring you a pot.
Yeah, they might, and then you hit the jackpot. Being a tea drinker is like being a Mac user, is what I'm saying, is that you're in a special group, and you have to work a little harder sometimes in order to get what you want, because you're not the majority.
But it's worth
it. Everybody just drinks coffee. You know, the worst thing, has this ever happened to you? The worst thing is you got a cup of tea at that restaurant, and they've served it to you, and you can pour it into the cup, and it's in the cup, and you're drinking it. And you've got about like a few sips left, and the guy who comes around to refill the coffee comes around and splashes coffee in it.
Yep. Yep, that happened. Didn't that happen to us at a conference? I feel like that was a thing that happened once.
It's possible. It certainly happened to me many times.
I've definitely seen it.
That's the worst. But it's funny because Diane wrote in and she was talking about rituals, and I thought that struck me as interesting too, that she said tea drinkers seem to have rituals. And I was thinking about that, you know, I think... If you talk to a coffee drinker, a lot of coffee drinkers have rituals with just because of the way it works, how you make coffee. I mean, you don't have to, but a lot of people are fussy about their coffee. They've got a device that they use to make the coffee, or they've tried a few different devices and settled on one. Mm-hmm. That's the coffee drinkers I have known at work, and family members seem to always be like that. And tea drinkers are the same way. I don't think you have to have a ritual. In fact, the sad result of are answering Diane's question, happy for us, but sad for her question about rituals, is we've used technology to replace the ritual, both of us in our lives, at least to a certain extent. But I don't think rituals are necessary, because for me the most important ritual is that I drink tea in the morning,
right,
and have caffeine in my body, not that I make the tea a certain way. But for some people, rituals and we're creatures of habit, and the rituals
Absolutely.
Are important.
Well, I grew up in a tea drinking family, and as such, there was a bit of a ritual to it, especially when I was a kid, or when I'm, with a bunch of family members, because there is, I have very distinct memories of my mom, making tea, after dinner tea, because that was a big thing in our house. Even though my dad is a coffee drinker, but my mom and my entire extended family on my mom's side are all tea drinkers. And so she had this really nice glass teapot, and then she would carefully brew the tea, and then it would go on this, I don't know if you've seen these, it's like a tea warmer. It's like a glass, almost like a glass lamp, that you put one of those little tea lights in, and then you put the teapot on top of it, and it essentially keeps it warm, which is kind of what we use. Our Breville have that keep warm function, which
yes.
it uses a
lot. Yes, it's a
yeah.
button.
Yeah, exactly. It's a button that generates a little electric warmer thing. But that was a very specific thing for me. And then, as I got old, I used to drink my tea with milk and sugar when I was a kid. And then I sort of weaned myself off both of those things throughout the years. So there is certainly a ritualistic aspect to it. But you're right that it's much less complicated and much less involved than it used to be. Although it's interesting you bring up the coffee thing, because I have recently learned to make coffee, because my girlfriend is a coffee drinker, and sometimes, very often, I'm the first one up, and so I will make tea, and I will sometimes make her coffee if she's having trouble sort of getting out of bed.
Oh, you're so nice.
I try to be nice, but yeah, I know how to use the coffee maker now. I'm not sure she knows how to use the tea maker, so we'll see if that ever comes up.
Yeah, it's I was thinking of ritual wise of a couple of things. I had a sponsor for Upgrade, I think, a while ago was the first off, I'll mention that there was a sponsor. My life is full of podcast sponsored products now. I shave with Harry's stuff.
You're like a NASCAR driver.
I know,
there.
And I sleep on a Casper mattress, and I have Mack Weldon underwear and the whole thing, right? But New Mexico Tea Company was a sponsor, and they sent me a bunch of samples, and I actually found they sell loose leaf tea on the internet, and it was it's very good, and that's and a good price too. So that's what I'm drinking most mornings now, and that's mentioned in the magazine. But the other thing that I was going to mention is there was a sponsor that was it's called Making Light. That's a candle sponsor, and their whole thing is about ritual, which I thought was interesting. That this is all about set a time when you want to focus, and you light a candle, and you've got the ritual of lighting the candle, and you've got the look of the candle, and they're all scented, so they've got like a scent, not a super overpowering, but a scent to them. And the idea there is to create a ritual, and to create a space in your life where that's a cue basically for you to get, I think they're the way they're selling it is like a cue to be productive, right, is to do that. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. And I think sometimes that's what rituals are all about. It's about either avoiding something or doing something, but it's about getting in a certain frame of mind.
Right.
I think.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think that's the tea for me itself is a ritual in that way, because I get my cup of tea and then I sit down and I start to work. And I find that on mornings where I don't have my cup of tea, I am perhaps not quite as focused or productive or in the moment.
No, we're tea.
Yeah. So that's not good. A couple times I have realized that I probably am at the point where this is, I won't say unhealthy, but I've gotten to noon or 1 o'clock and not had a cup of tea on a couple days, and I definitely start getting a headache now. So apparently the caffeine withdrawal is real.
I've never experienced that, I have to say.
Well, that's because you have tea all the time, right?
Well, I suppose so. No, every now and then I go someplace and there's no access to tea, and I just am sad that I don't have tea, but I don't get the headache thing. Or not access to caffeine anyway. So I've never experienced that, but I have experienced the jitters, but I very rarely get them. I think maybe I'm one of those people who is not super affected by caffeine, which is why I can drink so much tea.
Well, yeah, it doesn't do too badly for me. Like, I will drink it even fairly in the evening sometimes, and it won't really keep me up that much.
Yeah.
And I don't really get the jitters at all. So,
in fact, sometimes I find that if I drink tea after dinner, if I'm, like, out somewhere, I do it because it's enjoyable to drink it, and I think, mm-hmm. well, I might not get to sleep tonight. But generally what happens is it just keeps me more, I'm sort of awake and alert a little bit later, but it doesn't tend to lead to insomnia or anything like that. I think I just, it just keeps me, I'm a little less sleepy, I think, which is good. That's like the right amount of action that I kind of want. There is less sleepiness and not, staring at the ceiling at 2 a.m.
because yeah, exactly.
I had some tea at 8 p.m. or something.
If you're
like that.
If you're just tuning in, this is TeaCast.
TeaCast. Well, you know, so I was going to bring it around to other rituals too, because I was thinking about this in terms of our devices and how rituals apply there. And I'm not quite sure it's the same thing, but I think about things like, I want my dock on the right, and mm-hmm. I want these apps in the dock, and I use the dock this way. And actually, with this big iMac screen, the 5K iMac that I have, I actually I want my Slack window in the upper left corner. I want iMessage in the right corner. I want Twitter on the right corner. You know, I want that stuff kind of like off to the sides, and then the stuff I'm working on goes in the middle. I want Launch Bar installed. Yep. You know, I have these things that are the things that make my workspace, but they're also, you know, are they a little ritualistic? Are they a little bit like the comfort zone? I just kind of want to put everything in the right place so that I can do, so I'm comfortable, and I my chair and my keyboard and my trackpad, and I just everything just so. Not that I can't work in other ways, but this is like the way that I prefer.
It's funny that you say that, because as you were mentioning that, I look back and forth because of my MacBook Air is across on the other desk in my office, and I'm comparing the order of the apps in the dock. Yep, everything's in the exact same order. Yep. And I used to have a bunch of those little tweaks that are unfortunately not. I used to have my dock pinned to the bottom right corner, not vertically, but horizontally, which you can't do anymore. And that was the thing that I really liked for many years. And then I wasn't allowed to do that. And it took me definitely some adjustment to having my dock moved around. But yeah, you're totally right. There is a standardization, right? Like, because even more so than with our iOS devices, I think, you know, my iPad and my iPhone, I feel like, have very different use cases. So I don't always have the exact same apps in the exact same places for them.
Right.
But my Macs certainly are tweaked, and, you know, I tend to have the same applications installed in the same places and the same preferences installed and all of that. You're right. It is like getting your desk in order and making sure that everything is where you want it and where you need it. And maybe that sounds a little OCD, but I think it's probably just people are creatures of habit. I mean, they like to have their things set up the way they like them.
No, I think that's what we're coming back to, is that creatures of habit is what many of us are. You don't have to be, or you have areas where you care and areas where you don't care. I definitely hear, especially in the Apple kind of sphere, you know, there are a lot of people who come from a design background, and they want it the way they want it. The programmers often are like this too, right? They've got some very specific ideas about how things should work. And it's always funny, because I'm used to that, and I am sometimes one of those people, and I am sometimes not. Mm-hmm. And it's always funny to have a moment where I hear somebody, because I love it when I hear somebody talk about how this is really important and you got to do it this way. And most of the time I would say, I'm like, I totally get that. I totally get why you feel that way. And every now and then I'm like, yeah, don't care. And that's a little weird to be the one of those people on the outside of that situation and kind of not be finicky about that particular thing and kind of not care about it. And that happens. Like, I was talking to my wife this weekend about, we were talking about fonts, as you do.
Ah, fonts.
But the point I made was that there are, I understand some things about typography and notice things about typography, but I am not going to be able to identify a really random font on site.
Sure.
Some fonts, of course, but not a really random one like some people I know. And I am not going to get like really mad about fonts in general, about typefaces. Yeah, I know people who will become enraged by bad choices and practices in terms of type. And that's great. Good for them.
All the time.
But I'm not one of those. I'm just not one of those people.
I'm with you on that. I remember my earliest memory of fonts is still playing with all the fonts on the, you know, back in like, you know, Mac OS 5, yeah. 6, whatever. And
that's what
like,
everybody
just like
did when they got
San
a Mac.
Francisco, yeah, and mm-hmm. all that stuff. And it's like, I'm sure that I've always picked the worst font for any of these things. And all of my friends who studied typography, you know, threw up their hands.
Yep.
For years, I hated Helvetica. I always thought it was just really boring. And I know that's like, you know, someone out there is clutching their chest and having a heart attack right now because of that.
Although some people out there might be saying, yeah, what makes it boring is also what makes it great. I mean, there's some,
oh, sure.
there's
yeah.
some arguments like that too, but now I've, the older killed, I've gotten, killed those people who are clutching yeah. their chest, by the way, they're dead now.
Yeah, the older I've gotten, the more I think I've gotten on board with the whole simplicity and elegance argument. But as a, you know, 11-year-old, you're
sure.
like, no, I want my, like, my term paper to look like a ransom note.
Yeah,
that sounds way cooler.
I want action in my text. Action. It's an essay about something boring, but the font is... I did that in college. Some I would be like, I'm not using the standard fonts. I'm going to use a custom font.
I'm going to stand out.
I'm not going to use Times Roman. I'm going to use Palatino. That'll show them. Also, when you're writing a paper in college or high school, at least back in the day, which was the early days of like laser printers, I had access to a laser printer. You would choose your font sometimes based on whether it was big or not, because bigger or smaller, because you need to fill yep. out or fill
oh,
in.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So, you know, Palatino, I remember it as a big font that if I wanted everything to just take up that 2.5-page paper to be a 3.5-page paper, I could make it Palatino. And my recollection is that it would fill out more lines even without changing it from, you know, 13-point to 14-point or something like that. But if you went to Times Roman, sometimes it would be Times would squish it down. And it's like, no,
I haven't written anything.
I can't write anymore.
Yeah, I was telling this story just this past weekend about a paper I wrote in like my junior year of college, where it was like the last week of the semester, and I just really didn't want to write this paper for one of my classes, and I was up at like 1:30 working on this paper, and finally just, you know, courier 2.5 spacing to make like, you know, a 3 or 4 page paper, something that was not hard to write, but I was just totally fed up with it, and turned in that paper, which I did not do well on, but that might have also been the content of that paper. So yeah, we all played with the margins and all of that stuff just to try to eke a little bit more out of it without it being obvious.
Those are the games that we played.
Sadly, writing for the internet has kind of ruined that whole skill set.
Indeed. Hey, do you want to talk at all about newsy stuff that's gone on? I mean, we posted, you and I both, a whole bunch of links. If you look back at the Six Colors Archive for the 17th, it looks like we didn't write any real posts. We just wrote a bunch of links. But, you know, there was a lot of material in those links. And it was all largely about the FBI Apple stuff, which is going on, which is this huge story, and it's going to continue. And it says so much about so many different aspects of technology that seem to be coming to a head here in terms of encryption and law enforcement and government access and privacy and security. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. The thing that concerns me the most is I saw somebody say on Twitter, and I forget who it was now, but so sorry, Twitter. I apologize to all of Twitter, that the problem is that Apple is making a logical argument, mm-hmm. and the FBI and Justice Department are making an emotional argument. And yep. the logical argument is usually right, and the emotional argument usually wins with people. Because,
right, and even more in this particular mm-hmm. case, where this is a story that is so emotional, and I think the logic of it, I was listening to a story, it came up on NPR, and I'm always amused when stuff that we, you know, talk about in our sphere makes sort of the mainstream news, and it was the top story that day. And somebody was saying, oh yeah, hold on, we talked to so-and-so about this, hold on, it gets a little technical. And the technical part of it was talking about a UDID, you know, unique device identifier. And I was like, that is one of the least technical concepts that you could actually talk about in this case. So it makes me think, not only is it the logical argument, but there's enough complexity and jargon involved with it that a lot of people are just going to gloss over that logical part of it because they don't. It just takes a little more thought and a little more understanding, a little more research to figure out how that works. So people are just going to go straight to that. You're right. That's straight to that emotional point. Of saying, oh boy, why would Apple do this? They're just, you know, they're helping terrorists.
Yeah, there was a senator who basically said Apple has taken the side of protecting an ISIS terrorist. It's like, wow, okay, that is a spectacularly reductive statement. But people are going to make those statements because there are people who believe, especially in law enforcement, where it is their job to do this. The thing is, they need to be countered by people who are concerned about the civil liberties of all people, so that you know, people have rights that law enforcement cannot violate. So there's that aspect of it, and then there's the technical aspect of it. And you're exactly right. Like anything related to encryption is mind-bogglingly complex. It's hard for anybody to understand, and it doesn't mean that people are dumb. It means it's a technical and weird. It's like explaining quantum physics to people. It's weird. Yep. It's it goes against some of your assumptions. And I gotta say, I think the majority of people in this country think of encryption, if they think of it at all, when they're reading a story like this and they're forced to think of encryption for a moment. I think they think of it as like a big locked box with a key.
Right.
And that's not really what it is. And this idea of like, well, when you get the Washington Post editorial board writing a story that, you know, the Washington Post, so probably read by senators and representatives and other people in government as well, wrote a story famously last year where it suggested that software companies just create an encryption system with a magic golden key that would allow them to unlock all encryption. And that's not a thing that exists. It doesn't. That's not how encryption works. But you could definitely see that they think, one, oh, these wizards can do whatever they want. That's not how it works. And two, that that it's like a box with a lock, and you can have a key, and you can have a skeleton key for it. And that's right. Just not that. So, but I think it's so easy, unless you take the time to put in the effort to even begin to understand this technical dense stuff, it's much easier to fall back on metaphors. And in this case, the metaphors don't really work very well. And then there's the retreat to safety of, whenever there is an attack, while it is important to try and understand why an attack happened, to see if there are ways to stop attacks from happening in the future, there is also a rush by people who want to expand the role of law enforcement and give them more powers and do it at the expense of civil liberties and privacy and security. And, you know, there's nothing more secure than a police state. But we don't want a police state, right? We don't want a panopticon where people can – everything we do is visible by the government at all times. We don't want that, right? So where do we draw the line? Right. Because that would be pretty safe, because the government would know everything that is happening. But it would also be an oppressive society where the government controlled and knew everything about everybody. It's not – we don't want that, right? I think we could probably all agree on that, except for some very strange people out there. So where do you draw the line? And when you see senators pop up after a few months after a shooting and say in concert with the FBI, but we really need this now, it's hard not to look at that and say, you're using this egregious example to get access to something, and then you're going to use it for everything. It's because that's how it's going to work. Is the once this technology is out there and once this precedent is established, it's not going to be too long. And I know this is a slippery slope argument, but you can look at the history of this sort of thing, and I think it's a pretty strong likelihood that it won't be too long before your local sheriff is able to unlock your iPhone.
Well, and
because he's out to get because making a murderer.
Right. Well, you know, and I don't know. It's a tricky argument too, because I feel like part of me wants to believe in people being inherently good, even with all the evidence to the contrary. But you know, there are many different issues at stake here, and the truth of the matter is that in many of these cases, there are alternatives to this approach. I think the best sort of arguments that have been put forward about this are people talking about the fact, like, look, there's other ways, in theory, to get access to this information. They're just more expensive and more time-consuming.
Yeah.
This would be a lot easier, especially if they could establish a precedent going forward that would create some sort of framework for which they could do this all the time. Or in other words, I think warrantless wiretapping essentially is what they're looking for, the equivalent of that, but for breaking encryption into cell phones. You know, like, there is... there is absolutely the need for law enforcement to be able to retrieve vital information with the correct legal precedent, right? Like, there's absolutely a need for them to be able to get a warrant, to be able to investigate things, and to be able to get information that will help them apprehend or explain why things happen. I don't think anybody's arguing to that point. The question is, where are the limits on that,
right?
And what frameworks and what systems should be put in place to make sure that that's used responsibly and that it's not overstepping the bounds?
Well, and let's not forget that this court order actually is trying to ask, it's basically forcing Apple to instruct its employees to do development work to create a hacked version of iOS. And I retweeted a note from Chris Segovian from the ACLU, who is the Apple trivia, is the nephew of Sal Segovian, the longtime Apple Script and Automator product manager at Apple. That's not Segovian. It's not that common a name. They are related. And what he said was, would it be okay for the government to compel doctors and nurses to participate in the execution of a prisoner? And that's outrageous to draw that parallel. But the fact is, this is the government conscripting private citizens who work at a publicly held but a private entity to do specific work on the government's behalf. And I don't like that idea at all. That basically the government can say, "Hey, Apple, instruct your workers to do this project for the government." And so I find that really troubling. And if you talk to security researchers, they'll tell you there are zero-day exploits out there in the wild now that security researchers can use, and sure, that the government and governments do use, and spy agencies do use to open up these devices.
Yeah, I mean, you remember not that long ago we were having a big discussion about the NSA and security snooping programs, right, in all of our smartphones, or the exploits they were using to get access to this, the information they were collecting, right? That was pretty much the whole thing that led to Edward Snowden leaving the country, right? So, the big difference there is that those are intelligence agencies that are, in theory, not supposed to use any of that to snoop on American citizens. That's a gray line as well, as it turns out. There's a difference between the intelligence apparatus and law enforcement, or at least there used to be. And so there are so many issues tied up here. There are legal issues, there are moral issues, there are technological issues. And people are conflating can arguments with should arguments. There's a lot of different stuff going on. And I understand why this issue gets so thorny so quickly, and why people come down very hard on one side or the other, is because there are a dozen different arguments you could make about this, and each one is something that you could deflect and say, but what about this aspect of it, and but what if they can actually break into that, like, doesn't that mean they should? And you're like, I think part of the reason I resisted writing anything about this was not only because it had been tread by many other people, many of them much, much smarter than I am, but also because it's sort of a huge issue to grapple with and get your hands around. And so I sort of erred on the side of, like, let me just, as I see interesting arguments that are smart pop up, passing those along to sort of better inform myself and better inform our readers about what exactly is going on.
Yeah, here. I agree. It's it's a difficult situation. I mean, I think extremism on both sides of an issue is not helpful. And that's why I was really kind of upset by that one senator saying, Apple wants to protect a terrorist. It's like, Apple wants to protect its customers. Apple is coming from a perspective here of wanting to protect all of us who use Apple devices by creating a system that allows all of us to send messages and to have data on our phones that, if they're stolen, they can't be seen. Right. That data can't be accessed. They are protecting our information as it travels over the internet. These are ways that Apple is protecting our privacy. And it's not just from governments, but it's also from criminals. And I think that is a laudable thing. And you got to cool down the rhetoric a little bit, because Apple's not motivated here by, and other tech companies too, by protecting terrorists. That's not what this is about. But, again, to me, if you look at the extremes, you start to say, how far down this path do you want to go? Because if the argument is we should do everything possible to find out everything about terrorists, well, you know, should you start interrogating everybody in their apartment building? Should you sift through the possessions of everybody in the apartment building that, where they live, just in case? Should you find all of the people who share their religion in that city and interrogate them and search their apartments? At some point, a judge is going to say, no, that's ridiculous. And, we didn't even mention it, but this judge, this magistrate judge who ordered this, does this judge have an understanding of the technical aspects of this too? I'm sure she put in some effort, but it's also a very heated situation. So, this is the conversation that needs to happen. Is we need to cool it off and have a conversation about what is the role of these big companies in helping law enforcement, and the biggest issue, which is lurking behind all of this, which is the government going to force tech companies to break their security so that it can remain broken, so that they can look through it when they want to, and that is, I think, the biggest concern here. Is, you know, in the end, if Apple could work something, or if the FBI can find another means to read what's on that phone, that's fine. That's fine with me. I mean, it is an investigation. It should be investigated if they can. But it's the ramifications of that. Like, clearly the motivation here is to eventually order Apple to break end-to-end encryption, because they're furious about the fact that that Apple is building technology that Apple itself can't break.
Right. And I wrote a piece about this a few months back, when this sort of, before this particular incident came up, but there was still some back and forth about encryption. And at that point, I think, you know, the idea of, this is not the first time that the government has tried to essentially hamper encryption, which back in the 90s, folks who are using web browsers back then might remember that there were actually multiple versions of some of the browsers, like Netscape, depending on where you were geographically, because the export of basically really strong encryption was considered a munition. And so they had to put regulations on it to basically, because the government was like, oh, we don't want people outside of the US basically to be using encryption that we cannot crack. And the problem with that, among some other very bizarre choices, is that it really kind of, I feel like, hampered the adoption of certain types of technology. Because if you're outside, you know, the US and you can't, for whatever reason, get one of these browsers with like secure encryption, you're probably less likely to do like shopping online. And that was before, obviously, shopping online became a big thing. But one of the things I think probably accelerated the development of things like e-commerce was that everybody was using the same system, and it was a system that we could all trust, right? So much of the web is built on encryption, and so much of what we do in our everyday lives now is built on encryption, that when you start weakening that or chipping holes into it, it really erodes trust. And at that point, you can have some pretty unintended consequences, because, for example, if people start feeling like, well, I don't want to do my shopping online, not necessarily because I'm worried the government will see what purchases I'm making, but because I'm worried that people will steal my, financial information as I'm making these transactions, well, that's going to do a lot to dampen our economy, and that's not a particularly great thing. And it's really going to do a lot to dampen technological innovation.
Right. And if the U.S. government has a key to that gets them into the encryption, it only takes one person to feed that to China, and then China's got the key to the encryption too.
Yeah.
Plus China, that is the problem. Plus, Apple does business in China. So China, right. This is a fact, because we've seen it before in some of these cases. China watches very carefully what the U.S. government gets out of companies like Apple, and then they ask for it too. So then you're not just talking about U.S. law enforcement trying to find terrorists. You're also you're talking about the Chinese government then using it to find people who are democracy supporters.
Dissidents. Yeah.
Or people of a religion that is being suppressed by China. So yeah, it's any other government, right? The Russian government, the Indian government, the Iranian government,
and not just governments, but I think my cardinal rule of technology is always never bet against the
Absolutely.
Hackers. And as soon as that information exists and there's a way to circumvent it, you can't secure it well enough. You just can't. You know, we're secured right now by the fact that encryption is based on the laws of mathematics.
Until
quantum computers get affordable and effective. But right now, we're basically secured by something that none of us can, circumvent. All the failures in those programs come from people.
The math is solid.
And so, eventually, if you have a master key, Someone will get it. It's just the way it's going to go. Someone will find it, and then we are all screwed.
Who lost? Who? Where's the golden key, guys? Where? Who lost the golden key?
I mean, I lose my keys all the time. Imagine if you had a master key to everything. That would just be bad. Like, so maybe the master key ends up in the couch cushion somewhere, but, you know, you can't be sure.
Well, I hope everybody out there has appreciated this issue-filled, heated, issue-filled episode of the Subscriber Podcast. And if you have thoughts about this encryption stuff, you feel free to...
Or about tea.
Feel free to share it with us. There is a... And we're working on having a message board of some kind for subscribers. But for now, you can email us subscribers@sixcolors.com, or you can email me jsnell@sixcolors.com. Dan is dan@sixcolors.com. So you can let us know if you have thoughts about this or anything else in this. And also, if you have things you'd like us to talk about on the podcast or write about in the Six Colors magazine, you can do it there. I also have a Twitter account to tell you about. If you haven't seen it, you can follow the new Twitter account that is Six Colors Mag. That is the Six Colors subscriber Twitter account. And basically, while it's nice marketing to all Six Colors readers to mention every now and then that there are cool things that we're doing for subscribers and they should be a subscriber, I kind of wanted to have a place. This was a good idea. Federico Vitici did this for the Mac Stories, the Club Mac Stories subscription service. And I wanted to do it too, because it's a very good idea. This way we can communicate with you directly on Twitter about stuff that we're doing that is just for subscribers. And some of that will probably also get communicated to Six Colors non-subscribers, but we don't want to kind of overwhelm them with ads for the subscription service. I want to play it light there. But anyway, so you should follow Six Colors Mag on Twitter, and you'll find out about when we're talking. You'll find out what tea we're making. But we'll send that message encrypted, so you'll need to decrypt it.
Yes, I'm going to read my public key to you.
Oh, my. And then I'm going to leave this as a cliffhanger before we say goodbye. I'm going to leave this as a cliffhanger for future discussion in a future podcast or on sixcolors.com or in the magazine or elsewhere, which is just, Dan?
Yes.
I have an Amazon Echo behind me. Dun, dun, dun.
Alexa, add marshmallows to my shopping list.
It's not plugged in yet.